This is Audible.
Podium Audio presents Freefall, Book 2 of Expeditionary Force Mavericks, written by Craig Allenson, performed by R.C. Bray. Chapter 1. Well, this is just freaking wonderful, Derek Bonsu grimaced as he deactivated the Buzzard's rack of missiles. The weapons would not be needed, because they couldn't risk firing on the target, a small Kristang village that had been the team's objective for that morning. Now the Legion soldiers in the Buzzard's cabin were grumbling and bitching to each other. The flight from their base had been 90 minutes of bouncing through a raging blizzard, and it had all been for nothing. I knew this day would turn to shit. Despite the seriousness of the situation, Irene had to smile.
You knew that because you stubbed your toe?
Because the first thing that happened when I got out of bed was bashing my toe on the leg of the cot. That's a bad way to start the day, you know? Irene didn't reply. She knew the reason Derek had run his toe into the cot that morning was he had tried to avoid the pile of clothes she left on the floor, plus her gear bag. Plus, he first had to awkwardly crawl over her to get out of bed because his side of the cot was up against the wall of the shelter.
You need to tell Em.
Me? Derek protested. I told her the bad news last time when we were on Fresno.
See?
She reached across the Buzzard's center console and patted his face affectionately.
She already thinks of you as the bearer of bad news, so it won't hurt.
Nuh-uh. He shook his head. Not this time.
Fine, she relented.
Your aircraft?
My aircraft, Derek affirmed, keeping the Buzzard in a lazy circle, orbiting a control point 90 kilometers from the objective, or the place that had been that day's objective before everything turned to shit. The only good news was they had flown through and out of the blizzard, and the sky was mostly clear all the way to the objective. That would have been good if the Legion troops were landing to assist the evacuation of the village's residents. As it was, the only practical effect of the better weather was to provide a view of snow, frozen mud, and the tough, fur-like trees that covered the unwelcoming landscape. Since the Legion landed 9 days ago, Derek had seen the sun mostly when they flew above the ever-present thick layer of clouds. Not for the first time, he wished he had never seen that world. The mission was supposed to be quick, simple, and easy. Monitor the Kristang as they left a planet recently surrendered to the Ruhar. The world was called Jalaxico, and the humans of the Alien Legion had only half-heartedly given it the nickname Jellybean. The planet was just not important enough to merit an official nickname, and hopefully the Legion wouldn't be there long enough to remember it. Jalaxico was an Earth-like planet, if Earth's crust had significantly more rare metals, was larger, had 13% higher gravity, and circled the local orange dwarf star on an elliptical orbit that took it from the middle to the outer edge of the habitable Goldilocks zone. Also, if the level of free oxygen was 8% less than Earth normal. Jalaxico had been settled by the Kristang for mining rare metals, though that justification for the expense of traveling there had been rendered moot 300 years ago when robotic mining began in the rich asteroid belt of a star system much closer to the core worlds of Kristang territory. Since mining became unprofitable, the remaining inhabitants of Jalaxico hung on mostly out of stubbornness, or because they couldn't afford to pay for passage on the one ship per year that swung by to deliver supplies and take aboard anyone fortunate enough to get off the miserable world. Jalaxico might have continued its slumber forever, with a slowly declining population, except the most recent wormhole shift had given the Ruhar easy access. The Ruhar needed certain rare metals, especially palladium, lanthanum, and yttrium, to make their jump drives function properly. The clan that owned Jalaxico actually had no official presence there, and the 7,000 Kristang of various squabbling subclans did not like being sold out by their leaders. Accordingly, the Ruhar had assigned the Alien Legion to handle the task of kicking the lizards off the planet. It was a test, with the Legion force under the command of Emily Perkins. She had one understrength battalion of 650 humans and 80 Vertkris, plus two transport ships and one destroyer. She wasn't happy with the force structure, and she also knew the hamsters didn't care.
If the Legion could not manage the evacuation of 7,000 lizards who were living in isolated villages, then the whole concept of the Alien Legion needed to be reviewed. The evac had gone well for the first 8 days, with most of the warrior cast and almost all of the civilians happy to get off the frozen ball of mud they called home. Then Irene and Derek approached a village early that morning, and the local leader had a message for the platoon leader. They knew it was trouble immediately, though Major Chan had been trying to handle the problem on her own. Derek and Irene knew that Perkins would want to know what was going on, so they only felt mildly uncomfortable about going behind Chan's back. Sometimes officers had to be protected from themselves. Instead of calling Emily Perkins directly, Irene sent a request up to the destroyer Wild Chida, a Ruhar vessel the humans referred to as the Wild Child. After a brief back and forth with the destroyer's communications department and then the ship's executive officer, Irene was connected to Perkins.
"Ma'am," Irene took a breath before continuing, "we have a problem."
Emily Perkins's own morning had been rather splendid, a fact that had her anticipating bad news. She had slept well, considering that only 4 hours elapsed between closing her eyes and swinging her legs onto the deck when the alarm woke her. The coffee, made from beans the Ruhar grew in a lab, was hot and delicious. Breakfast had been biscuits and gravy that tasted, if not like her mother used to make, as good as any diner in her hometown. The destroyer's crew had greeted her cheerily while they ate whatever food hamsters ate for breakfast. When she arrived in the Wild Child's Combat Operations Center, the overnight status reports had all been positive. Objectives secured, no casualties on either side, the overall plan was proceeding 2 hours ahead of schedule. The relentless good news had her on edge when Irene called.
"Strebik, are you going to ruin my day?"
"No, ma'am."
"Excellent. That is good.
I think the lizards have done that all by themselves," Irene explained.
Perkins lowered her voice, a gesture that had no practical value. The ship's Ruhar crew had excellent hearing, and the flight data recorder could pick up the softest whisper.
"Why am I not hearing this from Major Chan?"
There was the slightest hesitation before Irene responded.
"She is trying to contain the situation. Is she going to succeed?"
"No," Irene conceded.
Perkins suppressed a groan. There were two options when a problem was encountered. Try to take care of it yourself without adding to the burden of your superior officer, or notify your superior right away, hopefully with a plan to deal with the situation. Chan was taking the first option, figuring she could resolve the issue without Perkins needing to become involved. Choosing option one was walking a fine line. If the situation got significantly worse before the information inevitably did go up the chain of command, then Chan's choice of the do-it-yourself option could backfire on her. Perkins typically got pissed when her subordinates tried to hide bad news from her, but she had learned that she needed to balance the need for information with the need to trust her people in the field. There was a status call with Chan scheduled in 2 hours, so she could wait until then. She might have waited, except the Ruhar were closely monitoring all communications, and they were looking for any sign that the Human Expeditionary Force could not handle the mission.
"I'll contact Chan. Give me a quick summary of the problem,"
Irene told her. Perkins swore, and didn't care that the Ruhar and the destroyer's Combat Operations Center all looked at her with interest.
"Okay, Strebik, hold where you are."
She keyed the access code for Chan's personal Z-phone, bypassing the Major's communication staff.
"Major Chan, how's it going down there?"
Chan knew she was busted, and there wasn't any point to concealing the problem.
"We've got a group of lizards who are refusing to cooperate, ma'am."
"Refusing, like dragging their feet on turning over their weapons, or like using those weapons against us?"
Neither of those?"
Perkins raised an eyebrow.
"Oh? They're threatening to use weapons, but not against us or the against us or the Ruhar. They have keepers."
"Shit."
Perkins pretended she hadn't already heard that from Strebik.
"I've been trying to negotiate with the leader of the local subclan in the village, a lizard called Ashkala.
He plans a messy public execution of the four keepers he has unless we pull back out of his province.
Damn it. Perkins knew the Ruhar and the COC were all listening intently to the conversation.
What about the lizard administrator of the planet?
I contacted his staff. They told me that enforcing the ceasefire and withdrawal agreement is our responsibility, ma'am. The administrator will not step in unless the Ashkalagai directly violates the ceasefire or does something against the interests of the major clan. The keepers are considered personal property. Ashkala can do whatever he wants with them. Basically, the administrator told me this is not his problem.
Basically, Perkins spat.
The administrator is happy to let Ashkala take a shot at screwing up the whole mission for us. If it works, the major clan benefits. If not, the administrator doesn't lose anything.
Basically, Chen concluded. Yes.
Okay, Major. Perkins took a breath.
Good initiative.
But bad judgment, ma'am?
No. You saved me the trouble of another delightful conversation with my counterpart.
She meant the Kristang administrator of the planet.
The lizards had, of course, thrown up every roadblock they could to cause problems for the Legion. The Legion, knowing their opponent, had planned for roadblocks and delays. She didn't blame Chan for attempting to resolve the situation on her own. She also knew that the Major's plan to try reaching a compromise with the lizards did not have a prayer of working. Ending the call with Chan, she turned to the technician at the destroyer's communications console.
Connect me with this asshole lizard.
Which asshole lizard, ma'am?
The ship's executive officer asked. Keeping a flash of irritation from showing on her face, Perkins did not take the bait.
You know damned well which lizard. Don't play games with me. I haven't got the time.
The exec gave a curt head nod, and the technician pressed buttons while Perkins watched.
I'm in contact, ma'am, the technician announced. They're telling me that Grand Warrior Ashkala will call you shortly, at his convenience.
The lizard was making her wait as a ploy, and Perkins was not going to allow that to affect her. While she waited for the grand asshole to decide he had sufficiently shown his disdain, she walked over to the weapons console, gesturing the exec to follow.
Colonel Perkins, Executive Officer Felax said quietly, we received a standard request from Major Chan to stand by to provide fire support over the target village about 2 hours ago. I tasked two GBU-35s.
He referred to a type of Ruhar missile equipped with fragmentation warheads. They were typically used in anti-personnel strikes against relatively soft targets on the ground.
Also, we have a railgun locked on the target.
A railgun? Perkins's eyebrow got more exercise.
Isn't that overkill? The objective is just a tiny village. This grand asshole Ashkala commands, what, 30 troops, maybe less?
It's a precaution, Felix explained.
Sensible, she agreed.
We will automatically safe the railgun if any of your troops are within 45 kilometers of the potential blast radius.
Got it.
She knew Chen had pulled her team back from the starting line when the Major learned there were keepers in the village. They made small talk while Perkins waited for the grand jerk-off to grant her an audience. She liked the executive officer of the destroyer, and the feeling seemed to be mutual. Felax saw the Alien Legion as a net positive for the Ruhar military and their society overall, so he was eager to help the Legion succeed in what was supposed to be an easy and simple mission on Jalaxico. The delay gave her time to think about what, if anything, she could do. The Kristang could be bluffing about publicly executing the Keepers, but she didn't think that was the case. There wasn't any reason to bluff. And since Ashkala had announced his intentions to the administrator, he and his subclan would lose face if he backed down. Unless Ashkala was exceptionally stupid, he could not hope to actually stop the Legion from taking the planet. The world was too remote, too unimportant for his people to put up a major fight against the takeover, especially as the major clans had agreed to cede the planet without a fight. No, Ashkala likely had more realistic goals. Boosting his own standing and dealing a humiliating blow to the Alien Legion. If the mission's schedule was delayed significantly by publicly torturing and killing four humans, that would prove the strategy the Kristang attempted on Fresno was valid and demonstrate the weakness of the human side of the Legion.
Maybe, she considered, she could adjust the schedule so that Ashkala and his people would be the last to leave the planet in exchange for not slaughtering the Keepers. That would give the Grand Asshole the ego boost he craved while maintaining the overall schedule. It would also show future opponents how to get what they wanted from the Legion. Let the camel's nose under the tent, so the saying went, and the camel would soon be sleeping in your bed. She couldn't be seen as giving concessions to preserve the lives of four people. She didn't see how to avoid that.
The lizard is ready to talk, Felix interrupted her thoughts.
Put him through, Perkins ordered, mentally steeling herself for a difficult conversation.
Am I speaking with the commander of the enemy fourth?
The voice was harsh, but had a lisp that made it sound like speaking even through the translation software. Perkins had to tamp down a giggle before she answered. Ashkala sounded like a vampire in a low-budget movie.
This is Colonel Emily Perkins of the Human Expeditionary Force. Do I have the honor of speaking with Grand Warrior Ashkala of the Yellow Fang Clan?
Technically, the Yellow Fangs were a sub-clan, but she figured it didn't hurt to puff up the asshole's ego.
You do have such an honor. I am Ashkala of the Yellow Fang, Grand Warrior, Keeper of the Sacred Chalice of Reen, Holder of the Nine...
Wanker of great frequency, Perkins muttered under her breath and made a jerking-off gesture with one hand as the Kristang went on naming his titles, real or imaginary.
What?
The lizard screeched as the wild child's crew laughed when they got the translation of her remark.
My apologies, Grand Warrior, Perkins said quickly. The Ruhar communications equipment is experiencing difficulties.
Ah, that seemed to satisfy him.
The Ruhar are widely known as incompetent in their use of the technology they have stolen from other species. My time is important. What do you wish to speak about?
It is my understanding that you were planning a...
She paused. A what? She didn't want to use the term public execution.
A spectacle for the public.
Oh, the lizard replied.
That? It is of no importance. As we are being forced to leave this world, we must decide what to take with us and what to leave behind. Under the terms of the agreement, I am under no obligation to turn over any of my property in usable condition. To that end, we will be demolishing buildings, disabling vehicles, and destroying our power generation facility.
Yes, Perkins clenched her teeth. That is, you're right. I was referring to the humans you have.
My keeper slaves?
He feigned surprise.
It is a waste to transport property of such low value, so we will be discarding them before we leave. Your Legion is being very stingy on allowances for property aboard the transport ships. I thought the Keepers could be at least of some use in training my warriors how to kill humans.
Why do you ask?
We consider those humans, the ones we call Keepers, to be traitors. She held to the official line from UNEF HQ. After Fresno, they had debated how to respond if the Kristang again used Keepers as hostages. The plan was to act like the Keepers were not important, and to negotiate to trade or to purchase them. If that plan didn't work, the mission commander was to utilize their best judgment. Meaning Perkins had to clean up the mess by herself, and she would get criticized no matter what she did.
We would like them brought back to Paradise, the world you call Predasis, for punishment. I would like to discuss an arrangement that could be to our mutual benefit.
Ah, but, Colonel Perkins, why would I ever want to benefit you?
Very well. I will indulge your foolishness. Here are my terms. The Alien Legion will withdraw from this world.
His voice turned more harsh, spitting words into the microphone.
Or I will personally demonstrate just how much abuse a human body can take over several agonizing days before a horribly painful and public death.
Ashkala, there is no need for—
Do not interrupt me, human scum! I am done talking with you and your primitive kind. You will give me your answer with a schedule for withdrawing your people from this world within 1 hour. If you do not reply in 1 hour, I will begin my demonstration in a very public fashion. Your primitive people will no doubt enjoy the show.
The transmission cut off. Perkins saw that Felix was trying to avoid looking at her, embarrassed for the human commander. He expected that she would give in to the Kristang demands, or perhaps declare that the Legion needed to withdraw so the Ruhar military could take direct control of the operation. It would be the end of the Alien Legion. "Excuse me," she said, gesturing for Felix to step aside. The Ruhar did move, with a questioning look. When he saw that she was walking toward the weapons console, he moved to block her. "Colonel?" he asked softly.
"Is this ship under my command?" she demanded.
"Well, I... surely you..." "That question requires a yes or no answer," she stated. "We call that a binary solution set. Yes or no?" He grimaced.
"Yes, of course."
"Emily, think about what you are doing," he added in a whisper.
"I have thought about it.
A lot." "Comms, get Ashkala back on the line. He's not..." "Oh," the technician expressed surprise.
"Got him, ma'am."
Perkins flipped up the cover that guarded the railgun controls. The weapons guidance system was still locked on target. Hovering her thumb over the firing stud, she forced herself to speak calmly.
"Ashkala?"
"Yes, Perkins." He skipped her rank as a sign of disrespect.
"I have an answer for you, right here."
She jammed her thumb down on the firing stud. The wild child shuddered as a dart was flung along the rails of the gun that ran two-thirds the length of the destroyer, accelerating the kinetic weapon to 24,000 kilometers per second.
3, 2, 1.
The overhead view of the village was replaced by a bright flash, then the sooty top of a mushroom cloud, churning with mud and debris that used to be a miserable little village.
"Holy sh—"
Irene gasped as she turned to look out the cockpit window at the mushroom cloud boiling up in the mostly clear blue sky. Derek already had the aircraft in a gentle turn away from the village, increasing power and trimming the controls for the best rate of climb. At 90 kilometers away from where the dart struck, the shockwave would not be a danger to the buzzard, but it always paid to be safe. Plastering her left hand to the inner lining of the cockpit, Irene craned her neck to keep the mushroom cloud in view as the buzzard swung away. When the aircraft completed the turn and the village site was no longer in view, she slumped in her seat, the straps automatically tightening around her.
"I can't believe she did that."
"What else could she do?"
"She didn't have a choice," Derek said quietly.
"I know, it's just... I can't believe she actually did it."
"Em is tough, we know that. The rules of engagement she got from UNFHQ were total bullshit. The brass just didn't want to make the decision. They stuck her with it."
"Derek, honey," she patted his forearm. "I know all that. I'm not surprised. I just..."
"Yeah, me too." He kept his hands on the controls. "It's a shock."
She tapped her lips with a finger.
"Hmm."
"What?"
"You know what? I'm trying to feel bad for those people. The keepers, I mean, not the lizards."
She knew there had been civilians living in the village, and the deaths of those Kristang were likely to cause more of a headache for Perkins than the loss of 4 human slaves.
"And I got nothing."
"They made their bed, right?"
"It's not that."
She shook her head.
"Either way, they had nothing to look forward to in their lives. This was a mercy killing."
Derek was not sure the keepers would have felt that way, but that was above his pay grade. He made an adjustment to the autopilot, and the buzzard began another turn. Irene was not in such shock that she missed the aircraft's change of attitude.
"What are you doing?"
Derek shrugged.
"Setting course for the next objective on the list. We still have a job to do on this rock, right?"
Perkins safed the railgun, taking its energizers offline and securing the cover over the firing stud. She moved carefully, deliberately, using the time to think through her next move. When she turned away from the weapons console, the entire crew of the COC was staring at her. Most of the faces displayed shock, perhaps horror. But a few, including Felix, had a different response. It might have been admiration.
She took a breath before addressing the crew. My people have learned that you can't negotiate with terrorists.
Felix gave an exaggerated nod to be sure she understood the gesture.
You may have saved human lives in the long run. The Kristang will see there is no point to using their human slaves as hostages.
I hope so, Perkins agreed. She knew she hadn't been given a choice. Not really. It was either four human lives or the alien legion. The legion was key to her plan to rescue the billions of humans on Earth, or failing that, to secure a future for humans elsewhere in the galaxy. She had no problem with the logic of her decision. The emotional impact was another issue. What really bothered her was not knowing what she would have done if Ashkala had 40 keepers, or 400. At what point would she have been forced to retreat, or at least send a message back to UNFHQ on Paradise asking for orders? She hoped if the lizards ever tested the Legion by using hundreds of keepers as hostages, that she was not in command on that mission.
Felix, contact the Planetary Administrator's office.
Colonel, there was a note of caution in his tone.
I suggest that you do not...
Don't worry. She stiffened to suppress a shudder. I'm not going to take a hard line with the Administrator. I am not taking any shit from him, but... She sighed. I need to offer compensation for the property they lost.
You are offering compensation?
Felix's eyes grew wide. He knew Perkins was not so callous that she actually believed the keepers were nothing but property.
Colonel, if you did want to play tough guy with the lizards, that is an excellent way to do it.
Chapter 2. The Assassin's Guild representative on the Kristang-held planet Kobamek stepped out of the aircraft that had brought him to the checkpoint that guarded the tunnel's entrance, which itself was blocked by massive doors. Before he could get to the doors, he would have to pass through three fences and an energy shield that would disassemble the molecules of his body if it were not deactivated for him to pass. Also, there were well-armed guards who appeared to have itchy trigger fingers and glared at him with suspicion, eager for action. When they saw him step from the vehicle, their first reaction was suspicion, despite his aircraft having been cleared through restricted airspace, plus receiving an escort from two fighter aircraft that still circled overhead. Their second reaction was a mixture of disgust at seeing the Achakai robe he wore as a member of that reviled group, and fear when they saw the Assassin's Guild patch on his chest. Assassin Emeritus Tingels Pomanto was retired from the business of direct killings, yet the patch still inspired fear. Even at his advanced age, he was a deadly force, and the guards at the tunnel entrance knew it. Pomanto, one of the guards said as he scanned the dishonored one, taking a long time to be extra thorough. The guard did not fear for his own life. He feared what would happen to him, his family, and everyone associated with him if the assassin managed to sneak weapons inside the clan compound at the heart of the city. The compound had been attacked before, and clan leaders killed, at the start of the civil war that had the city outside partly abandoned and in ruins. It was true that representatives of the Assassin's Guild were banned from taking direct action on their own, but who could trust the word of the dishonored? Pomanto noted without comment that the guard used his name without any honorifics, which was intended as an insult and bothered him not at all. After a lifetime of enduring insults, he no longer cared. Two other guards scanned him, requiring him to remove his robes and jacket. Getting into the tunnel was a long and tedious process, longer than normal in an attempt to humiliate him. He paid no attention. The Fire Dragon clan leaders inside the compound had requested his presence. If he were late, then they would wait for him. Through the tunnel in a low-slung open car, he emerged into sunlight again as the car drove across the courtyard of the compound. Not caring who watched him, he looked up to where the pyramid-shaped central residency tower showed signs of battle damage that had not been repaired. He noted the location, shape, and nature of the blast damage that had occurred when missiles struck the tower as the opening move in the current civil war that was ravaging Kristang society.
It was still a mystery how the Black Tree Clan had gotten missiles into the secure compound, and as a member of the Assassin's Guild, his examination of the damage was professional curiosity. He did not see how it was possible to have done what the Black Trees, or some other clan, as the Black Trees still denied any involvement, had done. Maybe the Achakai could use what he had seen. Or maybe it would continue to be a mystery. Without making eye contact, he strode purposefully across the courtyard, through another series of checkpoints, inside a bunker, and onto an elevator that took him deep below the surface. Automatically, he tracked how long the elevator descended and estimated how fast he fell based on how the pressure on the bottom of his shoes lessened. It might be useful to know how deep lay the secure quarters of the Fire Dragon clan leaders on Kobamek. He was mildly surprised to be ushered into a round room that was empty. The guards accompanying him indicated he should walk forward into the center of the space, treading along a cheap-feeling cloth over the rich carpet. The cloth was there, he knew, so the soles of his dishonorable feet did not contaminate the carpet. As soon as he departed, the cloth would be taken away and burned. He waited, and waited, and waited, without complaint or external sign of annoyance. Finally, a door opened, and a single, richly attired male strode forward, trailed by two females who wore robes of the same colors. They were either wives or concubines. Pamanta was amused to see one of the females raise her eyes from the floor to steal a glance at him. That was a bold act that she might pay for later, her curiosity about a real-life assassin overcoming her justifiable fear. "Honorless one," the clan leader said, sitting in the only chair, the females kneeling beside him. "I will be brief, for being in your presence disgusts me." Pamanta only bowed slightly, observing the proper forms, and no more. If the clan leader was irritated at not provoking a reaction, he kept it to himself. "We wish to offer a commission to your people, a target that I am sure will need to be approved by whoever you call your leadership." Pamanta bowed again and asked the obvious question. "Who is the target, honored leader? Will this be an assassination, a kidnapping, or some other action?"
"The target is a human named Emily Perkins. We want her dead."
With the Legion Battalion having just returned from Jalaxico, those lucky soldiers had the fun task of accounting for all their gear, because the bureaucracy demanded it. Sergeant Jates had the dubious honor of conducting the inspection, which was more disorganized than usual, because half of the platoon's gear had been transported on a different ship. Seeing that Jesse was busy helping a clueless soldier get himself sorted out, and Shauna was talking with an officer on the other side of the field, Jates called on another victim.
"Chaika."
Yes?
Dave had been standing to the side, watching in amusement as the platoon got ready for inspection of their gear.
"What is it, Sergeant?"
"Get a tarp and lay out your own gear," Jates instructed. "Make a template for the others."
"Oh. Sure," Dave said, relieved that he hadn't been asked to do anything difficult.
He expected that Jates asking to show the platoon how to lay out their gear was a vote of confidence in him, that he would not have lost any of his assigned personal equipment, that none of it was broken, and that he knew where all of it was.
"Be right back."
A few minutes later, he jogged over to Jates with most of his worldly possessions in or strapped to a rucksack. His personal gear did not include a combat skin suit, though he did have one assigned to him. Skin suits were kept in a separate facility controlled by the Ruhar, where the hamsters maintained equipment that humans were not qualified to screw with.
"Okay."
Dave unfolded the tarp and laid it out, getting the corner nearest him lined up with a stripe on the parade field. He had an audience, including Shauna and Jesse. It made him self-conscious. His assigned rifle, ammunition, rockets, and grenades were already in a locker in the company armory, so he only needed to account for all the other crap that UNEF had assigned to him in his official role as an infantry support contractor. Propping the rucksack up with one hand, he began emptying the side pouches first. Setting down his canteen, he lost his grip on the ruck and it toppled over, spilling the contents of the main compartment. Out tumbled rolled-up shirts, a belt for carrying ammo, socks, and...
Among the other items was a curious thing. An object shaped like, perhaps it would be polite to describe it as, resembling a cucumber. The object hit the tarp, bounced, and began buzzing so vigorously it flopped around on the tarp. Dave made a desperate grab for the object, missed, and sent it spinning across the tarp to buzz against one of Jates's shoes. There was a moment of stunned silence.
Chica.
Jates broke the silence, pursing his lips to keep from laughing. That's not mine, Dave protested, scrambling to his feet.
Of course not. The Verdcris Sergin looked at the object, then at Dave. Yours is much smaller.
The crowd burst into laughter. Even Jates, who was trying his best to scowl, had his shoulders shaking. Then, because Dave's day was already pretty much going just wonderfully, something else happened to make the situation even better, because of course it did. Lieutenant Colonel Emily Perkins walked over to see what the commotion was about. The crowd parted for her, and suddenly she was standing on the other side of the tarp from Jates. She looked down at the happily buzzing thing that did not belong there, then at Dave.
I can explain, he said in a strangled voice.
Chica, if that's my birthday present. Perkins cocked her head at the civilian consultant. You need to try harder.
Hours later, in the room they shared, Dave was sitting miserably on his bunk while Jesse lay on his back, still laughing.
Oh, man, that was classic.
I'm glad you think so, Dave muttered. He had stuffed the offending object in his rucksack and waited for the mirth to die down, but it hadn't. Seeing that there was no point to continuing the demonstration, Jates had dismissed Dave and designated another soldier to lay out a gear template. He hadn't even been able to talk with Emily, who had a car waiting to take her to a meeting with some group of UNEF generals.
I'm serious. Jesse rolled over to sit up. You have to admit, I never saw anything so freaking funny. Damn, I thought Jates was gonna pee in his pants, you know?
Yeah, Dave snorted. That would have been funny. Hey, Pwn, he used his friend's nickname. It wasn't you who put that in my pack, was it? Jesse held up his hands.
Honestly, I wish I had thought of it. It wasn't me.
Okay. Ah, hell. The platoon will have a good story to tell for years.
That's the way to think about it, Jesse agreed.
Hey, one other thing.
What?
Em. He used Maverick's private nickname for their commanding officer.
She is cool, you know. Like, she could have been pissed about it. Most women would have been embarrassed. She wasn't. She played along with the joke. She's cool, man.
Yeah. Dave saw the silver lining in the dark cloud hanging over his head.
You're right, she is. You're lucky. Like, you are so freaking lucky.
You're lucky to have Shauna.
Believe me, brother, I know it. She was cool about it, too.
She was, Dave agreed. Shauna had been laughing with the others, but she had given him a look of sympathy also.
So? Jesse prompted.
When are you going to stop stringing her along?
Dave looked sharply at his friend.
Me? When are you going to stop stringing Shauna along?
That's different. Jesse shook his head. Me and Shauna are the same rank. The ball's in her court, you know? On Paradise, every day is Sadie Hawkins' day. Girls have all the power.
You don't think M has all the power?
She's an officer and you're a civilian. The rules are different.
Like you said, it's Sadie Hawkins' day. The old rules don't matter.
All I know is you can't let her get away. If you don't ask her,
but you do want to ask her, right? The age difference is not a problem.
We don't care about the age thing, it's just...
She'll be a general someday, you know that?
I do.
And I'm what?
He looked down at the logo on his uniform, which read Paradise Security Solutions, the name of the company he technically worked for.
A glorified mall cop?
You're the same as me.
Jesse was mildly insulted.
Only difference is the insignia on our uniforms. Plus, hey, you can quit this gig anytime you want. You own that brewery.
I own a share in the brewery.
It's your smiling face on the sign, Jesse retorted.
Dave shrugged.
They needed someone famous to be out front when the company was setting up.
He was uncomfortable with trading on his military actions for a private venture. That level of discomfort lessened when he resigned from UNEF to be a civilian contractor. "We do brew the best beer on Paradise," he added with pride. "You're avoiding the subject. What do you want me to say?"
"I don't want you to say, I want you to ask.
Ask her before it's too late." The intensity with which Jesse pressed the point made Dave pause to think.
"Hey, Pone, what's up? Why do you care so much?"
"You're my friend, dumbass. Plus,
oh hell, if you pop the question to Em, that might clear the way for Shauna to get moving, you know?"
Dave sighed.
"I'll tell you what we should do."
"What?"
"Talk with Bonsu. A couple weeks ago, he asked me if I knew a place he could buy a ring, or have one made."
"Ooh," Jesse whistled.
"Shit, that complicates things."
"How?"
"Because if Derek and Irene," he figured it was acceptable to refer to the officers by their first names in private and on a personal subject, "are getting married, Em won't like you popping the question to her."
"What? Why?"
"Man, do you not know anything about women? She'll think you're only asking her because you're feeling pressure after Derek proposed to Irene, that's why. Plus, once Irene is engaged, the attention is supposed to be on her. My sister got engaged, and a week later our cousin Doreen announced she was engaged too, and getting married the month before my sister. My sister and my mother were pissed. Damn, I never saw my mama so mad about anything. Trust me, you need to ask Em first."
"I'll think about it."
"Don't think too long," Jesse advised. "Whatever your girl is cooking up, we could be off-world again soon."
The Legion was gearing up for something big. Jesse knew that because the Force was recruiting heavily on Paradise and adding personnel every day. The operation on Fresno had been conducted on a shoestring, with almost the entire available Legion force dropping onto that world. At the time, the Legion experiment was new and untested, and many billets had been unfilled. Fresno had technically been a success. Still, most people looked at how close the operation had been to complete disaster and decided they were better off remaining in civilian jobs on their adopted homeworld. Jellybean changed that. Not only was that relatively minor operation viewed as an unqualified success by the human population, the Ruhar government had been impressed and gave the go-ahead for UNEF to expand the Legion. Pay and benefits provided by the Ruhar were a powerful incentive to former soldiers who had not settled well into civilian life. And seeing Legion soldiers returning triumphantly from Jalaxico reminded former soldiers that they had come out to the stars to fight, not to become farmers. The new enthusiasm for the Legion was a double-edged sword, in Jesse's opinion. Adding to the combat power and sustainment capability of the Legion was a good thing. On the other hand, seeing recruits arrive for refresher training reminded him the expeditionary force that left Earth had been composed of whatever units the governments of the five nations could scrape together on short notice, meaning among the overwhelming number of serious, dedicated people were the usual collection of knuckleheads. Jesse's personal burden was a former Marine named Marco Santinelli, who had been a corporal when the force left Earth. The previous year, seeing no prospects for action and wanting to explore the opportunities of civilian life, he had left UNEF and set up a trucking business, transporting goods between human settlements that were scattered throughout the southern half of the continent humans called Lemuria. The business concept had been sound, the execution less so. The business failed within 7 months, and Santinelli had recently signed up for the Legion, as much for the steady paycheck as from any sense of patriotism. To rejoin the force, Santinelli, like many others, had to accept a demotion. With no new personnel joining, the force had become top-heavy. There were too many staff sergeants like Jesse, and not enough privates. As an incentive, the lowest rank was equivalent to specialist. For Santinelli, that meant he unfortunately was recruited in at the rank of Lance Corporal. Why was that unfortunate? The United States Marine Corps had a legend about a Lance Corporal Schmuckatelli, and every man who stood in for the worst example of screw-ups. Inevitably, Santinelli had been tagged with the nickname Schmuckatelli during boot camp, and it had stuck with him all the way, over 1,000 light-years from Earth. By joining the Legion, he was again a Lance Corporal, and not likely to climb the ladder of promotion.
Jesse had at first felt sorry for Santinelli, until he learned that the nickname was accurate. Marco Santinelli was a screw-up, a walking safety brief, and Jesse was stuck with him. The Mavericks' headquarters security detail had somehow along the way become a sort of dumping ground for screw-ups. Either that was UNFHQ's way of sticking it to Emily Perkins, or HQ figured it was best to keep the screw-ups away from frontline combat units. Whatever. All Jesse knew was that he had to watch Lance Corporal Schmuckatelli like a hawk, lest the idiot injure himself, or worse, injure a real soldier. The best example of Santinelli living up to his name was during introductory training for using skin suits. Each recruit was issued a set of genuine Ruhar flexible powered armor, albeit a suit that was considerably dumbed down for the purpose of training. The suits were designed to protect inexperienced users from harming themselves or anyone around them, and were pretty much idiot-proof. But the suit computers could not account for the endless inventiveness of idiots. The training session was on day 3 of the skin suit familiarization exercise, when new users were supposed to have already gained a measure of both confidence in what a suit could do and respect for how it could hurt them if they were stupid. The new users had performed easy runs on day 1, then proceeded on to running an obstacle course on day 2. The afternoon of day 3 was scheduled for weapons training, where rifles were synchronized to the suit computers. The morning was a relatively simple series of balance and jumping drills, intended for users to gain experience in trusting the suit to enhance their natural abilities, anticipate their moves, and protect them. The drills began easily, with Sergen Jates first climbing a platform that was 4 meters high and jumping off to fall onto the dirt surface of the training ground. He showed how to land and roll properly, moving on to jumping off an 8-meter platform. Jesse went next, using the proper technique. All the soldiers jumped first off the 4-meter platform with various degrees of skill, much laughter from their fellows and no injuries. Then, while Jesse's attention was diverted by helping a soldier adjust a helmet seal, Lance Corporal Schmuckatelli cut ahead in line to get his turn. He insisted on going 7th because that was his lucky number, and the other people mostly rolled their eyes and let him go, anticipating a decent chance they could watch him make a fool of himself. Their wishes were fulfilled beyond expectations. Schmuckatelli climbed to the 4-meter platform under the watchful eye of Sergen Jates, then crouched at the edge to jump up and gain a bit of extra height, as he had seen other soldiers do. Only instead of jumping up 1 meter, he kicked off the platform hard, bounding up to land awkwardly on the 8-meter platform above, where he slipped and fell before Jates could remotely override the idiot's suit and freeze him in place. To make matters worse than an 8-meter fall he was unprepared for, he had to show off by attempting to perform a showy Hollywood 3-point landing. It didn't end well.
"Ow, ow, 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 fuck, that hurts!"
he moaned as he collapsed, rolling over and shaking as he held his injured wrist with the good one.
"Schmuckatelli," Jates barked, pissed off at the idiot. "Shut your dick holster and move off the field."
"Ah, crap," Jesse snapped, pushing Schmuckatelli down on his back while he linked to the idiot's suit to check the medical scanner.
"I turned my head away for 1 freaking minute and I think my wrist is broken,"
Santinelli sobbed.
"It is just a sprain," Jates observed with disgust as he sent out a call for a medical team. "You also sprained your right ankle. It is fortunate you didn't tear ligaments in your knees. Coulter, help me move him off the practice field."
They easily carried the injured fool to rest on a bench off to the side of the platform, where he could continue to be an object of amusement and a living safety brief for the others. Jates motioned for the exercise to resume, while Jesse waited for the ambulance.
"I don't understand," Santinelli moaned. "It works when Iron Man does it."
Jesse snorted. "A 3-point landing looks cool, but it's stupid. Maybe a kung fu master can do it, but Iron Man is just movie magic. With your legs out like that, you don't have any leverage for balance. You also rolled your wrist under. That's how you sprained it. Next time, do what the instructors tell you to do. That's why we're here."
"Damn. Sorry, Staff Sergeant. It looks so cool, you know?
There's a lot of shit that looks cool, but is stupid. Like, you know how in movies the cool guys hold their guns sideways?" Jesse pantomimed holding a pistol at arm's length, cocked on its side. "You see how that's a move for morons? If you hold a pistol upright, and if it kicks back, it goes over your shoulder.
You hold it sideways, it can kick back into your freaking face. That will knock you down for the count.
Santinelli nodded silently, gritting his teeth against the pain.
I get it.
Jesse doubted that, in fact, the idiot really got the message. He would get the message when the Ruhar medics injected him with nanomachines so he could return to training that same afternoon. The tiny machines would stabilize the sprained areas, acting as artificial tendons and muscles while the biological features healed. It all sounded good, except the nerve blockers would only prevent the pain from being debilitating. It would still hurt like hell. Long experience had taught the Ruhar not to completely deaden feeling for injuries, so the affected person didn't aggravate the damage. With the first round of jump training over, the trainees clustered around Santinelli, asking what the hell he had been thinking.
You are gonna be hurtin' in the morning, one soldier laughed. I had that fancy hamster nanomedicine once. Works great, but it hurts like hell when it's active.
Jesse stayed out of the conversation, which somehow got to the subject of back when Santinelli joined the Marine Corps.
I had a high school buddy. We were supposed to sign up together.
Several soldiers nodded, knowing what that was like. Jates had come over to check on the injured Marine. Jesse flashed a thumbs up to the Verdcris. Injuries sustained in training were the responsibility of the instructor, in that case, Jates. Having a human injured while under the care of a Verd was not good for morale.
Your friend was supposed to sign up with you? Jates asked, pleased to see Santinelli was in good spirits. What happened?
Santinelli grinned, the grimace of pain momentarily wiped off his face.
My friend went to his girlfriend's house that weekend, Saturday. She was out washing her car in the driveway, and the guy next door was chatting her up.
Oh, Jates nodded. Your friend was worried this guy would move in while he was at boot camp.
He sure as hell did. The neighbor guy? His name was...
Santinelli snickered, finding his story enormously funny.
His name was Jody.
For real?
A soldier laughed.
For real, man,
Santinelli said seriously.
Damn, that is a bad omen, the soldier shook his head. I would have backed out too.
Jates didn't get the joke.
This Jody person, he has a bad reputation?
Oh, Santinelli stammered. I don't know the guy, never met him.
Then what is the problem?
It's not... You gotta understand, Sergeant. Jody is the guy who would bang my girlfriend while I'm away on deployment.
Ah, Jates nodded. That is very caring of you to think of your girlfriend's needs.
What?
Santinelli's mouth gaped open.
No,
Did you create this arrangement between your girl and Jody because you are frequently away, or because of your overall sexual inadequacy?
Hey, It's not my girlfriend. Jody bangs every guy's girlfriend when he's away.
Impressive. Jates nodded with admiration. I didn't know a human male was capable of such stamina. He must be exhausted. I would like to congratulate this Jody.
No, I...
Santinelli looked around for support, but everyone was laughing.
Look, Sergeant, every Marine, every soldier hates Jody.
Why the hatred? Based on what I know of you,
Jates stared down the hapless Lance Corporal. This Jody would be performing a public service if he banged your girlfriend. Santinelli gave up trying to explain. Just as the medics arrived to take him away for treatment, the Ruhar sadly shaking their heads at the stupidity of humans. Jesse went back to training up the new people, wondering how many of them would get recycled back to start the refresher course over again. One thing he knew for sure was that whatever off-world hellhole the Legion was going to next, he couldn't wait to get there.
Chapter 3. Major General Jeff Ross was in his office on Paradise, staring off into space as he thought about the best way to compose the official report about the Legion's mission on Jalaxico. Everyone already knew the details. He was documenting the mission because regulations called for an official report, and because he wanted to assure that history had all the facts. All the facts, including the full background of the controversial decision made by Emily Perkins. In the future, people whose only knowledge of the incident came from written reports needed to know. You busy? Brigadier General Lynn Besenson stuck her head through the doorway.
You're early,
Ross looked at the clock on the wall. Come in. I didn't expect you until this afternoon. Besenson sat down heavily in the chair. The clock was showing the local time as 11:18. Too early to indulge in a drink, which was probably a good thing. She needed a clear head during her scheduled call with UNEF HQ in less than an hour. Ross read her mind, pulling out a drawer on his side of the desk. You look like you could use a drink. Waving a hand, she shook her head. Not now, thanks, she said, wishing she had a glass of her favorite rum and 7-Up. Ironically, breweries and distilleries had been established by former UNEF soldiers, so getting rum on Paradise was not a problem. The nearest can of 7-Up, however, was over 1,000 light-years away. With a longing glance at the bottle of gin, Ross closed the drawer. The spirits, made on the planet's southern continent, did not taste exactly like any gin from Earth, because no one had thought to bring a juniper bush from Earth. The gin was good enough, until the earliest batch of bourbon had aged properly and was ready to drink. What's up? I got called into the Burgermeister's office this morning. Officially, the Ruhar woman in charge of the planet had the title of administrator, but Baterna Logelia found the human nickname of Burgermeister to be amusing. UNEF HQ had banned the use of the nickname in official communications, but everyone used it in casual conversation. She read me the party line about Jalaxico. Oh? Ross raised an eyebrow. He could guess what the Ruhar federal government had to say about the actions of the Legion on that world, specifically the action Perkins had taken to end the attempted extortion by Kristang. They are shocked and dismayed, etc. I'm getting a copy of the report later. I'll send it along to you. Nothing we didn't expect. No surprises. Did the Burgermeister tell you anything other than the party line? Besenson rolled her eyes. She sure did. She talked long enough I had to drink a second cup of that awful tea her office serves. I swear I don't know why the hamsters think we like that stuff. It tastes like perfume. Having been forced to drink the tea out of politeness, Ross could sympathize. He slid a tin of mints across the desk. These take away the taste. She mumbled with a mint in her mouth. Thanks. Off the record, some of the Peace Faction officials truly are unhappy about what Perkins did. They are debating whether to issue a formal reprimand. Killing 4 of our own people is bullshit, Ross interrupted. That's pure bullshit. He thumped a hand on the desk, displaying his anger. According to the Ruhar, keepers held by the Kristang are not our anything, and they are property, not people. The hamsters read that law to us on Fresno. They can't have it both ways. That was almost word for word what I told the Burgermeister. Ross snorted. We agree on the law. That's something. I get it that the optics aren't great. You're wrong about that. Besenson shook her head and popped another mint in her mouth. Their military is impressed and surprised. They didn't think we lowly humans could make decisions based on cold logic. The overwhelming feeling in their government is that humans took care of a human problem. They like the optics. Perkins showed the lizards they can't play that card again. Maybe, Ross considered. Unless the next time the lizards are holding 12 or 100 hostages, what then? The question made Lynn Besenson uncomfortable. I can tell you what I've heard around HQ, unofficially. What? That we can't backslide now. The policy will be no negotiating with terrorists. If the lizards are using keepers as hostages again, we hit the site, no hesitation. Well, shit. Ross sat back in his chair. You disagree? Hell no. I'm surprised HQ is suddenly seeing the light. This Legion initiative? We're either all in, he made a gesture like pushing a pile of poker chips across the table, or we're out. Good. Because off the record, HQ wanted me to find out what you think about the new policy, Besenson admitted. You can tell them that I am on board, 100%. Being in this job is all about knowing what you can do and accepting what you can't do. We can't save those keepers. They're screwed either way. And we can't let them distract us on the next op. Besenson had not been read in on whatever the Legion was planning next, All she knew was that it was big. Before UNEF shipped Perkins off to Jalaxico for what was supposed to be a quick and easy mission, the Mavericks leader had been shuttling back and forth between UNEF headquarters on the southern continent and the Burgermeister's office in the north. The debate within UNEF HQ was heated about whatever crazy scheme Perkins had proposed next. The one tidbit of information Lynn had learned was that Perkins had not done herself any favors by proposing the operation to the Ruhar before she got approval from UNEF. She had also gotten the impression from the Burgermeister that the proposal was considered wild, dangerous, and bold. Perhaps too bold. Ruhar strategic planning had become stodgy and unimaginative, and the planners were comfortable with continuing the same course that had caused the war with the Kristang to drag on and on, generation after generation. Lynn Bezenson was aching to know what the hell the Mavericks leader was cooking up this time. HQ is considering, she added, backdating the new policy, so the Lizards don't think the action on Jalaxico was only the decision of one rogue lieutenant colonel. That drew a laugh from Ross.
Rogue would be accurate, though, right?
Bezenson twisted her mouth into a wry smile. She did not say that HQ was unhappy with Ross about Perkins, expecting him to rein in the Maverick leader of the Mavericks. That expectation was unrealistic and unfair to Ross. UNEF HQ had created a monster when they set up Perkins as the public face of the Human Expeditionary Force, using her popularity with the Ruhar population to bolster the image of all humans on Paradise. It wasn't the fault of Emily Perkins that she was a dynamic, aggressive, and innovative officer. UNEF wanted officers to have those qualities. If Perkins took the reins and moved the force in a bold new direction, Bezenson thought that was due to the failure of UNEF HQ to develop and articulate a plan of their own. Anyway, Perkins was a problem for Ross. She had enough problems of her own to deal with. "I'm going to withhold comment on that subject, sir," she said diplomatically.
"Do me a favor, then. If you can get HQ to move along on releasing the policy, sooner would be better than later."
"The Legion has another mission?" she asked, a bit too eagerly.
"Rumors are going around."
"We might have another mission. It's," he spread his hands on the desk, "it's a hell of a thing if we get approval."
"I envy you," she admitted.
"Going off-world, you mean, or the action?"
"Both.
Making nice with politicians is not why I joined the army.
You know, I might have an opening on my team," he said casually.
"Oh?
It will involve work space-side, not planet-side, although you should have an opportunity to get your boots dirty."
"What's the job?"
"Sort of a forward space controller, a spotter for close space support missions." That surprised her. She had never worked with artillery, certainly not the big guns of starships.
"You need a brigadier for that?"
"The billet is being handled by a major right now. We discovered during our time on Fresno that the Ruhar need a Legion soldier on their ships to coordinate and prioritize fire support. There are always more calls for orbital strikes than the ships available can provide."
"You've got a major doing it, so why me?"
"Because you are a brigadier. That star you're wearing gets attention. Our people can talk to the ground and make judgment calls on which targets to hit. I need someone the hamsters will listen to. It's their ships that are at risk providing close space support, and they can be reluctant to move ships from their established orbital tracks. If a fire support request comes from a major, the hamsters will take it under advisement."
"You mean ignore it?"
"Same thing. If the request comes from a general, especially a general who is respected by the administrator of the Legion's home planet, that has authority." Bezenson could not conceal her disappointment.
"You want me to be a liaison officer aboard a hamster ship instead of here?"
Repeating the targeting directions of a major was not her dream job.
"No,
I want you to take charge up there." He pointed to the ceiling. "Theoretically, when we've got boots on the ground, the frigates and destroyers tasked with providing close space support are at our disposal. On Fresno, we found that wasn't quite true. If you sign on, I expect you to bust heads until the damned hamsters do what we need them to do."
"Bust heads, huh?"
"Furry heads, preferably, but you bust whichever heads you need to get us that fire support. Your first task will be to establish a rapport with the captains of the ships involved.
Establish a rapport?
Ross chuckled. That is a code phrase for laying down the law. Make them understand right from the start that those ships need to take direction from us. Within reason, of course.
What are the parameters I'll be working with?
Oh, hell, Lynn, there's a whole freaking manual for it. Bottom line is if you get a fire support request to take out something small, like a platoon-size enemy force, and the Ruhar haven't established complete space supremacy, you need to make a judgment call. Lack of timely fire support may cost us dozens of lives on the ground. But if the Ruhar lose a starship to enemy fire, even just a frigate, that is over 100 lives. Plus, even a frigate costs. He didn't know how to convert Ruhar currency to dollars, since there was no established exchange rate. Several billion, something like that.
Judgment call.
She pondered the idea. The point is, it has to be your call, not the hamsters. Don't take any shit from them, Lynn.
Busting heads. I like it.
She brightened.
Okay, I'm in. Where do I sign?
We're getting ahead of ourselves. I need to clear this with HQ. They may want you to stay in your current post, at least until they can find a replacement. Plus, the op hasn't been approved yet. If it gets approved, there's a whole lot of shit we need to accomplish before we have boots dropping dirtside. Forget I said that last part, he added.
What part?
She checked the clock. She needed to get moving.
Thank you, sir.
She stood, offering a handshake. Ross clasped her hand. He had not told her that in addition to her duties space-side coordinating fire support, he wanted her help with managing Emily Perkins. If managing Perkins was even possible. The Legion was going off-world, and soon. Nobody knew where yet. Rumors were flying thick and fast. What was certain was that the pace of training had been ramped up with units consolidated into battalions. All the additional people in camp meant a lot of work for the combat engineers, and everyone had to pitch in to set up facilities. Naturally, everyone wished to avoid extra work, so they kept their heads down when volunteers were requested for work parties. Jates stomped over to the group who were cleaning weapons. "I need volunteers," he growled. Shauna, Jesse, Dave, and the others studiously looked away, pretending to suddenly be very busy at whatever they were doing. Nert somehow had not gotten the memo.
Volunteers for what?
Everyone else groaned.
Nert, you idiot.
Jesse's shoulders slumped.
What?
The cadet asked innocently.
All I did was ask.
Dave rolled his eyes.
In the military, that is the same as saying yes.
Oh.
Nert was crestfallen.
I am sorry.
Well, Jates clapped his hands together happily, flashing an evil grin. Since the four of you so nicely spoke up.
Hey,
Jesse protested.
I didn't. Damn it. What will we be doing?
Nert asked, with much more curiosity than was healthy. Several of the latrine units that were set up yesterday were installed at the wrong site. They need to be moved and set up right, Jates explained.
Oh,
Nert sighed with relief.
That is not so bad.
You haven't heard the bad news yet.
Dave wondered if he could fake an excuse like death. No, Jates wouldn't accept something simple like death as an excuse. Those latrines, Jates's pass was impassive, though there might have been a twinkle in his eyes, have been in use since yesterday.
Oh.
It was Nert's turn to groan.
Now I am very sorry.
After they exchanged pleasantries that actually were pleasant for both of them, and sipped cups of tea, the Burgermeister got to the stated purpose of the meeting. Opening a desk drawer, she pulled out a message written on something like paper and pushed it across the desk to Lieutenant Colonel Perkins.
Emily Perkins, for your actions on Jalaxico, my government has issued an official reprimand. Consider yourself hereby officially reprimanded.
I am.
Perkins picked up the slick document, wondering what she was supposed to do with it. The thing could go in her personnel file at UNEF headquarters,
although that organization didn't keep paper records. Not knowing what else to do, she folded it and tucked it in her pack. Is that all, Administrator?
No. Now that unpleasant business is concluded, we can talk about something that is actually important.
Taking a breath for dramatic effect, she raised an eyebrow.
This should be going to your chain of command first, but since it was your initiative, you deserve to know. Your operation has been approved at the highest level.
Wow. Perkins had to tense her shoulders to prevent a shudder of relief. The sleazy actions of the Ruhar on Fresno had caused the political coalition of their federal government to fall in disgrace and scandal, bringing to power the party referred to as the Peace Faction. That party had been slowly but steadily expanding in influence over the past 3 decades, driven by a citizenry that had grown weary of constant back-and-forth warfare. Enough, said the leaders of the Peace Faction. The Federal Army and Navy of the Ruhar would no longer pursue offensive operations, no longer seek to conquer more and more territory. Although, that sentiment was not quite true, except for a minority of true believers in the Peace Faction. Offensive operations aimed at degrading the enemy's combat power, rather than adding new territory that would have to be defended, could be approved, depending on the circumstances. An operation like, for example, when Perkins had proposed for the Legion to hire itself out to the Achakai.
I am surprised, she admitted. No more than I, Logelia agreed with the sentiment. Rumors I have heard are that the Peace Faction approved this operation to keep the military from protesting directly. If your plan works, the Kristang will be less able to threaten us, making it easier for the government to rein in the military.
Good luck with that, Perkins said to herself while plastering a neutral smile on her face.
Thank you for telling me first. You are welcome. Although, Emily...
A shadow fell across the administrator's face.
This time, I am afraid that you might have been a bit too ambitious.
The senior leadership of the Achakai met deep underground on the homeworld of their people. Technically, they did not lead their entire society, only the Assassin's Guild, and technically the planet was not theirs to rule. The world belonged to an assembly of Kristang clans, whose warrior castes collectively controlled the world for the benefit of all. Well, all except the Achakai. The warrior caste didn't care whether the Dishonored Ones benefited. Specifically did not want the Achakai to benefit in any way. They were unworthy, without honor, unclean. Mercenaries hired to perform distasteful tasks and kept as far away from true warriors as possible. Regardless of their official legal status, the 7 men who led the major houses of the Assassin's Guild met in a secret chamber deep under an anonymous building in an industrial district. Above them, citizens of the world went on about their business, whatever that was. Less than 9% of the Achakai were mercenary soldiers of any sort, and fewer than 1/3 of 1% belonged to the Assassin's Guild. Most of the Achakai, like all of Kristang society, were females without any rights to own property or control their own lives. Of the males, most were ordinary civilians and had been all their lives, as were the lives of their fathers, grandfathers, and so on for generations. Whatever incidents that had caused their ancestors to lose honor and be banished to join the Achakai, those events were long forgotten. Among the Achakai, legends spoke of ancestors banished because they or their families had lost political fights, not conflict on any actual battlefield. Declaring someone dishonorable was a time-tested way not only to get rid of a political rival, but to have their property rights declared void, as that meant such property was then available to be dispersed among the victors to increase their own power and wealth. Few objected when a family who lost a political fight were subject to banishment. The 7 leaders of the Assassin's Guild, who all had survived many political battles within their own houses and within the guild overall, knew the history of their people, knew the true history, resented it to the very core of their being, ached to restore their rightful place in Kristang society. It was true that among the Achakai, on the world above and scattered throughout Kristang territory, were those who truly had behaved in a dishonorable manner. They had been banished to the Achakai, but rarely joined that society. Newcomers were generally shunned until they could prove themselves. Those who truly had shamed themselves by their actions were few in number and rarely survived long. After all, if their own clan could not trust them, why would the Achakai extend any trust? Master Takwindu thumped a stone on the wooden table to formally call the session to order. It was an ancient tradition, the stone well-worn from being held by generations of rough hands, the origin of that particular stone lost to history. Nonetheless, it was tradition, and the Achakai clung to the comfort of traditions, as they had few other comforts. Takwindu conducted the proceedings not because he held the most power in the guild, or because his house was the strongest, but because he had survived the longest. "This meeting will come to order," Takwindu announced without need, for the others were sitting quietly, each keeping their own thoughts to themselves. "We have all had time to consider the offer from this alien legion. The time to decide is now. Now or never. This opportunity will not happen again in our lifetimes or the lifetimes of our grandson's sons."
"The offer is not from the legion," Master Karat objected. "It is from one of their leaders. One human."
"No," Master Dolavejan said. "The humans and the legion." He spat the word as it was distasteful in his mouth. "Are nothing but pets of the Ruhar. The offer is from them." "Our intelligent sources tell us the Ruhar were as surprised as we were," Takwindu said quietly, "when the plan was presented to them. Now their government has approved the operation." "That matters not," Dolavejan insisted. "The Legion can do nothing without the approval of the Ruhar. Our enemies would not have allowed this plan to go forward unless it benefits them, by weakening us." Master Takwindu sighed to himself, showing no external sign of his weariness with the argument. "Who," he asked, "is us?"
"The Kristang," Dolavejan roared. "Have you forgotten all sense of honor? You would sell out our people to gain more power for yourself?"
Karat leaned forward, resting his elbows on the table.
"We do not belong to Kristang society. They have made that clear to us. My people are the Achakai."
Dolavejan knew he had pressed the argument and lost many times since the astonishing proposal had been brought back from the failed action at Fesnico. He tried a new tactic.
"Should we commit treason against our own flesh and blood to restore our honor? The clans already think we are beneath contempt."
Takwindu held up a hand to forestall angry words.
"Dolavejan, history is written by the victors. If we are successful, we will become a clan, and no one could deny our honor."
Master Bagawan spoke for the first time.
"Dolavejan, I will speak only for my house and my family. My ancestors have sought to restore the honor that was stolen from them."
He paused as agreeing murmurs rolled around the table.
"For millennia, this has been our quest, the focus of our existence. That quest is what has kept us from falling into despair. It has kept us alive. This is the first time that we have a realistic opportunity to achieve the dream we have all held for so long."
Dolavejan nodded, knowing he had to agree. Also because he did agree.
"The consequences, if we fail, then," Takwindu stated,
"we will not fail. The question is, should we try?"
"No," Karat said, to the surprise of everyone. "The question is, can we win? Brave words, brave deeds, will not win the day if we are not properly prepared. Can we trust this legion?"
"Their leader is a female," Dolavejan noted with disgust.
"She is an alien," Karat observed. "They are different. We cannot judge them by our standards, though our standards are clearly superior. This Lieutenant Colonel Perkins, though a female, has proven herself to be brave and resourceful.
On Fesnico, she was a formidable opponent. She even overcame the treachery of the Ruhar. We should not forget that. In this proposed operation, she trusts the Ruhar. She trusted them on Fesnico also, Dolavejan grumbled. Master Bogawin smiled, revealing sharpened fangs.
And she has learned from that experience. Do not forget, Dolavejan, that on Fesnico she won.
Another round of murmurs rolled around the table.
This time, Dolavejan reminded them all, she will be risking our lives, the lives of all Achakai.
Dolavejan laughed softly.
My life is at risk every moment, not the least from you, my esteemed colleagues.
That remark drew a knowing laugh from the others. Assassinations of house leaders usually came from within that particular house, but it was not unknown for disputes within the guild leadership to be settled by means other than calm and rational discussion. What protected each of them were the formal rules for such assassinations. Often the burden of meeting the rules was worse than the pain of allowing an enemy to live.
Come, friends. We do not have to decide the fate of our people today, here. This operation is planned in stages, and we can back out with little consequence along the way, until we are committed.
The discussion rambled on, in what Takwindu was pleased to see was a productive fashion, until it was time for a vote on whether to take the first step. For such an important decision, where the lives of not only all house leaders, but every member of the Achakai would be at risk, the vote needed to be unanimous. That was not a formal rule. It was the consensus decision when the proposal was first considered. All eyes turned to Dolavejan. If he continued to object, the operation would be stalled until either he changed his mind or the leadership of his house was changed. Dolavejan took a breath, enjoying the attention. Karat spoke again.
Before we proceed, I must inform you all of a complication. All eyes shifted to the leader of House Minchao. Before we were presented with this opportunity, the Minchao representative on Kobamik was approached by the Fire Dragon clan there and offered a contract. As the commission is somewhat unusual, he requested time to confer with the sector coordinator, who contacted House leadership here, as is our procedure.
Others around the table nodded, their houses having similar procedures for potential high-profile contracts.
The contract was properly vetted and accepted. Why is this an issue? None of us have suggested we stop accepting legitimate contracts, either for assassinations or mercenary support.